Anyway, been talking, been having quite a few tea time sessions while Ajahn Janako has been away and having just returned, and I've been we've had a lot of really nice discussions in tea time the past couple of weeks. One or two of the themes that has come up that I also reflect on a fair amount. Questions around people exploring different traditions, being new to the practice, or even not so new, but still exploring all the different options that are available with Dhamma teachings, particularly here in the West, have just about every flavor of practice, every tradition in some way or another represented. And kind of negotiating ways through all of that to try and find something that is meaningful and useful to tap into, spend more time with, dig deeper. And also, kind of along the same lines, even within a particular tradition, what kinds of meditation practices to work on or develop. And if you're finding that you've gotten stuck in one, when to move to a different one. And how even different teachers, say, within the school of Theravada Buddhism, interpret and understand the teachings from the Buddha in different ways. So it's kind of sometimes hard to know what to do, where to focus, where to put one's attention in that part of the path. Of course, the contemplative practice is one aspect of our practice, which is a full-on training of body, speech, and mind, starting from precepts and living a good life and helping others and being generous, and all the way up through developing our practices of contemplation, all the steps supporting that. But more specifically, I find my own practice keeps revolving around a few major themes. We often talk about how important it is to have a tool bag of different contemplations that suit the changing nature of our minds. Sometimes we are experiencing certain mind states that respond better to ways of examining them and ways of looking at them, or ways to quell the unpleasant ones or to encourage the pleasant ones. So, the mind isn't just kind of a single experience of one sort or another, one flavor or another. We have many different ways of experiencing the world based on our own past karma, the ways that we've attended to our experience in the world around us, and the results that we see right here and now. So many different mind states come up, many different qualities come up, and sometimes they're difficult ones, and there's different ways of dealing with those, and then there's a multitude of skillful states that we want to encourage and nurture. So we need a bag of tricks, in a sense, or a medical bag with a number of different kinds of medicines or treatments inside to choose from. One of the hallmarks, I think, of at least many of the Krubha Ajahns in Thailand, in our tradition and related traditions, as I was learning in my early years too, there tends to be an emphasis on several core meditation practices, several contemplations, core contemplations, that are encouraged for all young monastics and middle monastics and older monastics, everybody to develop to a way so that when certain needs arise, you have this tool bag to dip into. And I find that there's actually a sutta in our teachings, which most of you are probably familiar with, or many, that contains four particular teachings or four particular contemplations that are, I find, useful to have as part, really mostly my major repertoire, using some other contemplations also as well. There's all told at least 40 subjects reflections that we can bring into our practice that are described in various ways, not as a complete list like that within the canon, but found dispersed throughout the canon, but four that pretty much everybody should get into their bag of medical treatments. And the sutta that it's that I find very useful is the Meghya Sutta, which is in the Udana collection, the Meghya Sutta. And some of it is also found in, I think, in the Anguttaras, Anguttara 9s maybe. But it's a story that starts with a fairly new monk in training named Meghya, who is the Buddha's attendant at one particular time. And he's just spending time alone with the Buddha. In his wanderings, he discovers a very beautiful mango grove that's suitable for abiding and contemplation. And he asks the Buddha permission to go and stay in this grove and meditate on his own in a solitary meditation for a period of time. And the Buddha suggests maybe it's too soon to do that, or he doesn't say it quite that way. At first he just says, no, I don't think so right now. You know, I need an attendant. It'd be good for you to stay around here with me. But Meghya has got the proverbial bee in his bonnet, and he's asks the Buddha three different times, and finally the Buddha says, well, that's what you want to do, you're intent on striving, then go ahead. And so Meghya does that, and fairly soon realizes that he's bit off more than he can chew, his mind is overcome with all sorts of difficult mind states, obstructive mind states, negativities coming up, and desires coming up, and he finds it all pretty overwhelming, and kind of sheepishly goes back to the Buddha and says, okay, well, something's not working here. And then the Buddha gives him a set of instructions for, I think, as he somehow terms it, when the mind development is not yet mature, there's, you know, a few things that are more of a preparatory nature that one needs to do to bring that mind to maturity, where you can then, you know, go off on your own and practice more in solitude. And the first five things that he says is preparatory to the meditations that I'm thinking of, but the preparatory conditions that one needs to bring in are, first of all, being around good, supportive Kalyanamita spiritual friends who can help guide you. So it's not good to just, full of inspiration, run off and find a nice, quiet, private place and just, you know, sit there hoping that you're going to attain Nibbana right then and there. You need the support of people who have at least partially walked on the path and can help guide and provide that general kind of support that we all need. in this practice. So hanging out with good people, first condition. The next condition that one should establish for oneself is a very strong commitment and development of what they call restraint in the Padimokkha, or essentially learning precepts, virtues, sila, that are supportive for your training at whatever level you're at. Whether it's the five precepts as a layperson in the world, eight precepts in a more renunciate way, or the full precepts of a fully ordained monk or a nun in the tradition. So developing not only the morality, but also levels of varying restraint depending on your precepts, developing the restraint in the Padimokkha. And then also engaging frequently in discussion of the Dhamma, talking on all the various aspects so that you begin to learn a broader set of the teachings, the ways of developing the path that lead to the goal, and just deepening the understanding through discussion and talk about how to live your life, the qualities that you're trying to develop, the qualities that you're trying to abandon, and using your Kalyanamitta in a very useful way with Takan Dhamma. Then the Buddha also outlines kind of the various aspects of one of the path factors, right effort. Really developing a sense for what wholesome qualities you want to bring up and develop in your own heart, in your own mind, and which unwholesome qualities that you can start to identify that you want to start to abandon and let go of. This is the actual practice that we call right effort. Abandoning unwholesome qualities that have arisen, preventing unwholesome qualities that haven't arisen from arising, developing wholesome qualities that haven't yet arisen, and maintaining the wholesome qualities that have already been developed. So the fundamental aspects of right effort are something that helps lead one to the stage of maturity in practice. And finally, as a supportive condition for developing that maturity, contemplating and really starting to understand, at least at a beginning level, the characteristic of characteristics of arising and ceasing, heading towards a deeper understanding of anicca. But at least at some level, starting to contemplate and observe the temporary nature of our experience, the changeability of our experience. Particularly, I think, it's not expressly stated in the sutta, but the contemplation of the temporary nature of this particular body, this particular life, this particular set of mind experiences, and realizing that everything that arises, including this body and this mind, these faculties, everything that arises has its lifetime and then passes away. And even if not experienced or understood right yet on a very, very deep level, that reflection gives rise to a sense of urgency and a sense of kind of reality of what our life in this world is all about. So those five conditions that one needs to establish before one is sufficiently in a good place to to realize further the teachings on a deeper level. And then the Buddha, then he goes to outline those four contemplations that he urges Meghya to develop. The first one is the asubha practice, the contemplation of the unattractiveness of the body as a counterpoint or as an antidote for sensual desire, sensual desire being one of the strongest fetters that we have to get an understanding of and not be overwhelmed by, a fundamental basis for suffering, that kind of sensual craving that leads us into craving, clinging, and dukkha. I'm not going to really explore that a whole lot because I've talked about that a lot in the past few weeks or month or so, but just to know that that is encouraged to be one of those basic contemplations to develop in one's kit of treatments. Second one is developing the practice, contemplation, development of metta, loving reflections on loving kindness, as a counter to aversion. And I'll come back to that a little bit. The third one is anapanasati, mindfulness of in and out breathing. And the fourth one would be a further development of the anicca sanya contemplations, contemplation on the perception of inconstancy or impermanence, anicca. I think the one that's been sticking out in my mind is, and also has come up in some of the tea time discussions around the practice of metta bhavana. It's worthy of just reflecting a little bit. There was a question a little while ago at a tea time about how to develop that very sublime and expansive state of mind that is concerned with the well-wishing for others' happiness, because that's not only a wonderful place to dwell, but sets the stage for an ease of mind that really is quite uplifting and very conducive to also the development of wisdom, that vast, spacious sense of kindness to oneself, to others. Is a very, very useful basis to jump off into further contemplations to develop calm and insight. So it's not only an antidote to ill will or aversion, but it's a great starting point for developing insight, in my estimation. And you know, there's all the traditional ways that we have received teachings, often developed in the commentaries and taught to us in the ways of developing a sense of well-wishing to ourselves, and then gradually broadening that to through people that are close to us, dear to us, people that are more neutral, people that are giving us a hard time and we have some negative feelings around. So learning gradually how not to limit that sense of well-wishing in a very narrow way, but to broaden it and let it grow and expand into a universal well-wishing for all beings, for all beings in existence everywhere. And that's a lovely state of mind, boundless state of mind, and something that is a balm for many of the troubles in the world that we experience these days. And you know, that is a useful technique. Sometimes it gets a bit, if you do it a lot, it can get a bit, routine or get a little bit stale sometimes just saying those kinds of words. And so I just really, in my practice, I try and keep it simple again and not quite worry so much about having universal loving kindness for all beings right from the beginning, but starting with reflections that help bring that quality to mind. Sometimes the words are just too much, and so I often find visual images of soothing situations, or remembering times when somebody's been very kind to me and very helpful to me, and the sense of gratitude that I feel for that when I think of another being who's wishing me well, and then wondering what it is that they're experiencing as they're helping me, as they're wishing me well, what their state of mind is, and kind of then saying, well, I can feel that way too, not only to myself, but also in return to that person, to other people, and to expand and share on that perception that comes up of the kindness that people have shown to me. And the feeling that that brings, even more importantly, more than the image, then associating it with the actual affect of experience, the feeling in the heart, the feeling in the body, and just allowing that feeling to be there and nurture that with, if you need to, refreshing that image or that memory. It doesn't have to be of another human being. It can be something, creature of some sort that brings up that sense of warmth or caring, protection, and, you know, just really allowing yourself to sink into and enjoy that, the result of that image, that memory of well-wishing, and to allow that to develop as far as it can. And if it doesn't get quite to all beings in the universe, you can still enjoy the actual perception. Sometimes finding a label for it, a one-word label, as you develop it too, is very useful. And then oftentimes, if the mind's in an agitated state or a difficult state, just invoking that one word that's associated with that wonderful feeling will bring that feeling right back up to the top. And it's that quality, I mean, not only for one's meditation, development of meditation experience, but just how to try and get through this world these days especially, it seems like. There's so much, if you're attuning to the outside world at all, you know, and following things like news stories and things, which I actually recommend limiting as much as you can, because there's a lot of weird stuff, negative stuff, cynicism, you know, paranoia, all sorts of stuff going on out there that's difficult to bear sometimes. But, you know, just developing this ability to set that aside and reflect on these images and the qualities and the actual experience of metta, loving kindness. It's a very soothing balm for troubled times. And developing an attitude of strength with it too. It's not just a kind of a soft, you know, very squishy kind of a thing. It's a very, very strong and potent attitude, mental state. And not succumbing, not falling to the easy tendency to move into reaction and negativity, no matter what's going on, no matter what's coming into your life, no matter who's bringing up stuff that seems problematic, difficult, challenging. I remember listening to a talk once that Ajahn Suchito gave and describing some of these strong and challenging circumstances, people that are coming up and putting a lot of negativity into the world. And he phrased it very nicely as a reminder of, don't ever, ever, ever let anyone hijack your loving kindness. And that's a phrase that comes back into my mind when you know, you see some of the difficulties and negativities out there. It's just, yeah, don't let anybody hijack your loving kindness. Protect that, nurture that, return to that. Anapanasati is, of course, a go-to for probably most of us, mindfulness of breathing to help settle the restless mind, to help settle discursive thinking, returning to the body, not just, you know, necessarily in and out, breathing at a very narrow, specific place, as I often talk about, but really the breathing as an experience of energy, movement, rhythmic movement throughout the whole body, staying tuned, in tune with the whole body, returning to the bodily experience, the gentle expansion, contraction, rhythmic qualities of breathing, and just letting the thoughts do what they will do, and letting any kind of sense of agitation or restlessness settle, and using that quality of bodily presence to really help ground one. The fourth contemplation that the Buddha suggested to Meghia, and again, in addition to the other three, one that I find very useful to keep at the fore of my practice, returning to over and over again, reflection on anicca, perception of impermanence. And in that sutta, the Buddha says it in a very beautiful way too. It's like when one develops the perception of inconstancy or impermanence, then that helps to establish the perception of not self. When one perceives not self, that leads to the elimination of the conceit I am. Elimination of the conceit I am is nibbana here and now. So the contemplation of impermanence, inconstancy, developing that as a perception in even more subtle ways than the ways of contemplating the death of this body or the changing nature of the mind, but bringing it to a moment-to-moment kind of perception, so that as the mind grows more still and as we settle into the body, that we really tune into the experience of this inconstancy arising and passing right in every single moment of experience, no matter whether we're experiencing sensations in the body or mental activities, feelings and perceptions as they arise and as they cease, thoughts as they arise and as they cease, but right, staying right present with that that experience right in that moment and seeing very deeply this constantly moving nature of our experience, moment to moment, right here and right now. And with that deepening contemplation and the stillness of the mind that is observing that all, observing that flow, that rhythm, that expansion, that contraction, that transiency, then one realizes that there isn't any agent in control. This sense of not self, the perception of not self, the understanding that this body isn't ours. It's following its own laws of nature. This feelings and perceptions and thought formations and emotions, all of the aspects of what we call the mind, are essentially following their laws of nature as well. And they're doing what they're doing based on this law, these laws of nature. And as we contemplate that and see that happening over and over again, this whole set of assumptions that we make about the these five khandhas, these five aggregates of body and mind, they start to drop away. And we don't hold a sense of self or ownership over these experiences. It becomes more just a flow of experience that we don't need to hold to or identify with, cling to in any way. And as that understanding and that perception of anatta, not self, deepens, then that serves as the basis for a complete elimination of what's called the conceit, I am, asmimana, one of the last fetters to break up in the path to complete liberation. And when that happens, as the Buddha says, that's nibbana, here and now, unbinding, right in this moment. So it's sometimes a bit confusing. What's the difference between the perception of not self and the elimination or the experience of the elimination of the conceit I am? And they're similar fetters, but on the second one being on a much more subtle level. The teaching that comes from a bhikkhu who's getting very ill, getting close to his death, Kemaka, elucidates that very, very beautifully. And in brief, he's talking to a group of elders who are questioning him about his understanding of the practice, and is saying that yes, he has a sense and an understanding of how he doesn't hold a sense of identification with any of the five aggregates. He doesn't identify his body as who he is or in possession of it in any way. And the same with the aggregate of feeling and perception and mental formations, consciousness. He doesn't hold them in regard to himself with a sense of self, a sense of ownership or a sense of identification. Yet he still does have this kind of very subtle sense of I am, what they call the conceiving I am or the conceit I am, and describes that with a couple of similes related to odor, the sense of smell, and that suppose you have a cloth, actually the first one is consider a flower in its entirety with its pistil and stamens and stem and leaves and petals, and that there's a scent associated with that, but yet you can't, you don't identify the scent in relation to any particular part of the flower. You don't say the scent is part of the petals, the scent is part of the pistil or the scent of the stamen, it's part of the stamen or the leaves or the stem or whatever. It's just there. It's hovering in relationship to the entire flower, even though you don't identify it with any particular part of the flower. Similarly, with a cloth that has, say, been cast off and that you've acquired, maybe even, who knows, maybe from a corpse. Corpse cloth is one of the requisites that the Buddha talks about. And that you take that cloth and you wash it thoroughly many, many different times in the appropriate soap or lye or cow dung they used in that time to get it as sparkling clean and pure as possible. So that it's free from all of stains and difficult, you know, stains to get out of it. It's free from that, but yet you can still detect a scent coming from it that's not fresh and pure and clear. There's still an odor around that cloth. And it's only until you let it kind of settle and rest in a closed casket, maybe with some encouraging scents, that finally, over a period of time, the scent finally fades away and disappears. So both those analogies are kind of descriptive of what it's like to maintain this subtle sense of the conceit, I am, this very subtle sense of self, different from the actual holding to a view of this body or this mind being who I am. So the contemplation that the Buddha is encouraging, Meghya, that fourth contemplation, beginning with the anicca sanya, perception of impermanence, through to the fruition of understanding of and the elimination of the conceit, I am, nibbana, here and now. So these four contemplations are key ones, I think, very strongly encouraged in our tradition, very much a part of my ongoing practice over and over and over again. It takes a long time for those of us with thick heads to kind of incorporate all of this. Keeping it straightforward is, I find, very useful, keeping it simple and just plugging along. And you have, if you have all of these techniques, these four techniques as your primary toolkit to draw from, then clearly that will, when fully developed, that can take you to full liberation. Many of the other contemplations that the Buddha offers are also wonderful contemplations. I find digging into the contemplation of death, Marana Sati, very useful for motivation. The contemplation of the peacefulness of Nibbana, the peacefulness of release, what that might be like. It's very useful for inspiration. And then all the other ones are great too. But those four basic ones, I'd encourage people to consider developing, and if they're not already a part of your toolkit, to bring them in and keep working and developing until they can help free you. So I think I'll just leave that for this night's reflection. It's enough, and we'll call it an evening.